You're listening to The Food Talk Show, produced by Channel Radio. It's the Food Talk Show with me, Paul Andrews, and the lovely Sue Nelson. Good afternoon, Sue. How are you?
Good afternoon, Paul. I'm absolutely fine. I'm going to be talking about my favourite topic. Well, my two favourite topics today, actually. Wine and food.
Well,
so wine and
who'd have thunk it?
Wine and eating out, actually, is my favourite things.
Absolutely.
So we've got the lovely Isabel from Raw Wine Fair.
Right.
And we're going to have a chat with her on the phone. And she's got an amazing fair taking place on the 12th and 13th of March.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to know all about that. And then in the studio today, we have got Tony and Nikki. And they've got different restaurant offerings, really. I've been to both places personally myself. I can recommend both.
Right.
So Tony is the Blue and White Cafe. Quite a famous place around
yeah,
here.
Yeah, it's well known around here, isn't it?
Yes,
yeah,
we'll have a good chat about that.
Yep.
And then Nikki is from the Hythe Brasserie. And I love eating there.
Right.
I just eat everything that they do. Just, you know, when you turn up and there's loads of choices and you
just go, keep bringing it until I'm full.
I love that. So it's really nice to talk to Nikki.
Mm.
Any favourite restaurants of yours? We're going to have quite a Kent-based programme today. Mm. So any favourites in Kent that you're really keen on?
There's loads of places that I like eating and they come and they go. I mean, at the moment, I've tended to eat at the Milk House at Sissinghurst. Which isn't far. I live in Tenterden, so
I passed that in the car, but I haven't been in.
Yeah, that's okay. I quite like that. I was talking about this earlier, actually. I have winter places and summer places.
Yeah.
So in the winter, I like the Three Chimneys at Biddenden because it's all, you know, open log fires and all the rest of it. In the summer, it's no good because it's dark and smells of soot. Yeah. But they don't have the fires alight, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
So I tend to go
courses
there.
Courses for courses.
Yeah, I go there in the summer, in winter. Yeah.
Mm. Mm. I mean, Tony runs a place that is absolutely famous for its breakfast.
Mm.
And to me, it doesn't matter whether that's summer or winter. I love
it. Oh, no, breakfast is breakfast. There's no messing about with that.
No,
we don't get into salad for breakfast or anything,
do we? I'm going to really, really talk to Tony about breakfast. Really, really important subject. Before we get Isabel on the phone, you're dying to pay a little bit.
I've got some tunage, but I just want to make a point, really, because I saw
it
today, and it kind of wound me up a bit. I was reading a report. Actually, I heard it on our news bulletin earlier that experts are now saying that we really ought to eat 10 a day, fruit and veg.
You don't even eat one, Paul.
So. I know, exactly. There's no fruit in a kebab. What's the matter with them?
Yeah. I mean, you don't even eat one.
No, exactly. No, that's not true. I always have extra chili on my kebab.
Yeah, I'm not so sure.
Extra chili on my kebab.
I'm not so sure that's fine.
But the interesting thing was, I looked up the story on the BBC news website, and there were three stories back to back, and it said experts say you should eat 10 a day, and underneath it, a news story from last week, which said experts said you should eat 7 a day. And underneath that was a story that said experts says the amount of fruit you eat a week has no bearing on what... So it's no wonder people take no notice of the government and their advice, really, is it?
Well, science is a difficult thing. And I think the thing with food is it's really difficult to prove because when you actually take a sample of people, what about their other lifestyle stuff? So if they're getting a lot of exercise or they're drinking a lot or they're smoking, food might not get absorbed in the same way through your body.
Yeah.
It's actually very, very difficult to get precise figures on things because so many other things affect what goes through your body.
I think, without getting too political about this, I think a lot of this is driven by organisations kind of paying for research to come out with whatever they want to come out with. The reality is, I think most of us know, most of us eat too much and don't exercise enough.
I don't know. I eat just the right amount and exercise the right amount.
Do you? It's you, is it? You're
yeah,
the one.
I'm the one.
You're the one. And I think most of us realise that you can eat what you want as long as you don't go too mad and as long as you don't do it too often. And, you know, an occasional bit of healthy food is not a bad thing. Yeah.
A lot of healthy food and the occasional bit of bad food is not a bad thing. That's the way round you need to consider, Paul.
No, no, no. Let's not get carried away.
I'll tell you what. Let's get Frank Sinatra on.
Yeah, shall we?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's have some cheesy Judy.
Okay.
Someone said drink the water, but I will drink the wine. Someone said take a poor man, the rich don't have a dime. Go fool yourselves if you will, I just haven't got the time. Yes, you can drink the water, but I will drink the wine. Someone gave me some small flowers, I held them in my hand. I looked at them for several hours, I didn't understand. Go fool yourselves if you will, you can hold out your hand. I'll give you back your flowers, and I will take the land. And I will drink the wine. Sometimes I'm very, very lonely. There's only me to care. And when I'm very, very lonely, I want someone to share. I'm gonna drink the wine. I'm gonna take my time. And believe in a world that is mine. Someone gave me flowers, held them in my hand, looked at them for many hours, didn't understand. Go on and fool yourselves if you will. You can hold out your hands. I'll give you back your flowers, and I will take the land. And I will drink the wine, and I will take the land.
That was absolutely dreadful, Paul.
Did you like that?
No, I'm
that
really
was just
sorry.
For you.
I'm really sorry about that, Isabel. I'm so sorry about that. It's absolutely dreadful.
I'll pick that special.
Yeah, I know.
I didn't think that was that bad. And you know, we need encouragement.
Exactly.
We need to drink more wine. So
you do well. You're fine with putting that message across for me. I'm absolutely fine with that. So, Isabel, let me just do a little introduction of you and the Raw Wine Fair. It's taking place in a couple of weeks' time, which is great, and it's in London. And yep. I think it is fair to say that you've been a trailblazer, actually, for wines that are grown and made naturally around the world. And you've been doing that for 5 years. And your real focus is on the artisan wine movement, isn't it? So could you just explain a little bit about what you mean by artisan wine movement?
You know, I can't hear you very well, actually, Sue.
I'm sorry about that. So I'll just repeat that question. So tell me a little bit about what you mean by the artisan wine movement.
So, you know, the if you look at the way wine is made currently, you know, we have this idea that, that wine is an artisanal produce, that it's made naturally, that just grape juice sprouts of the ground and it's just fermented and bottled. And that is really far, far from the reality, unfortunately. You know, wine is in fact, you know, by the vast majority of wines produced are in fact made in very, you know, in very large volume, made using actually tons of additives and processes and gadgetry. And at the end, what you have is a very tightly controlled product. And that's, you know, largely to do with the fact that if you grab a bottle of wine on your supermarket shelf and you try and find out what ingredients have been used, you can't find that information because there's currently no ingredient labeling laws.
But Isabella, I understand that there's quite a movement for people to try and get ingredients on wine labels. I don't know if anybody's making any headway on that, but certainly...
Yes, I mean, it is something which is happening. You know, you hear voices sort of... Yeah, I'm just back from the States, and I had conversations with people there who are trying to lobby. We've tried to sort of raise some questions. There's some associations in France trying to do the same. But, A, you know, there's a huge lobby against ingredient limit. Ingredient labeling on a bottle of wine.
I wonder why.
So it's a very complex issue. But you know, alongside this, when we talk about artisanal wine and what we try and do at the fair, Raw Wine Fair, is really promote people who don't work like this. Promote people who work, you know, by A, looking after the land, by farming organically, biodynamically, without using any synthetic chemicals, and then who make wines, you know, very naturally and not without using any additives, bar a little bit of sulfite sometimes. So these farmers, these makers are world apart to what a, you know, much bigger industry is doing. Sure. And the fair focuses on telling the story of these small growers.
So just to explain your Raw Wine Fair then, basically there are 150 growers in attendance at the event. And then what you do is you have very, very strict criteria, don't you, to allow
yes.
them to be there.
So you can't, yes, so basically,
you know, just rock up if you're a you know, huge supplier. You've got to meet these very strict criteria.
Yes, I mean, we have a very sort of tight church of quality that sort of, and all of that is available on the website. Mm. rawwine.com, but you know, essentially they have to farm organically, they have to ferment using, you know, indigenous yeast population, so spontaneous fermentation, no gadgetry, nothing really added apart from small amounts of sulfites.
And is it true that the grapes have to be hand harvested if you're going to exhibit, is that right?
Yep, and there's all hand harvesting, so no heavy machinery in the vineyards.
And trod, presumably.
Sorry?
Trod with people's feet. No, Paul.
Bare feet.
Well, some of them do, actually. You'll be surprised.
Oh, I thought
actually,
so.
Quite a few people do that. But what sets us apart, really, is our commitment to transparency. And we're the only place in the world where you can go, either when you come to the fair or online, where you can find out exactly how much sulfites was used to produce that wine. And we ask analysis to all our growers. So everything is audited. And which means that when people come to the fair, they know exactly, you know, what they're drinking. So there's no ingredient labeling anywhere else, but in our little world, we make sure that people are completely transparent. And if they do use anything, and the only thing would be some sulfites, then they have to declare exactly how much and show us, you know, analysis.
Absolutely, Isabel. Is there any particular region, area, country in the world that is more into artisan wine than anywhere else? Is it particularly prevalent in certain places?
So it's more prevalent, I would say, in Italy and France.
Okay.
And I think that's very simply because, you know, there's a very, very strong and long history of producing wines in France and Italy and to some extent Spain. So there is a longer history of organic production and of people who've kind of kept making wine the way their great-grandfathers was
sure.
making wine and who didn't really get sucked into the kind of the very modern production methods of the 70s and 80s in the wine industry.
And from a business point of view, How are people finding this? Because presumably one of the reasons that we have mechanized wine production, if we can call it that, is to produce large volumes and make sales and all the rest of it. So those artisan producers, how do they get by on a business point of view? Are they struggling? Is it difficult? Or is the market bearing artisan wine and paying a premium for it because of the quality of it?
So that's a really good question. You know, in fact, I would say that, of course, those wines come at a premium because everything is pretty much sort of handmade and made in tiny quantities. Mm. Plus, you know, they're organic, so their yields are even lower than normal. Mm. Unfortunately, I would say that the market, there is a following for these wines, and essentially you find them in small retailers, in restaurants and bars. Unfortunately, these wines tend to come from lesser known sort of, I would say, wine regions or appellations.
Sure.
And as a result, they're not able to command, you know, the pricing that they should be in comparison you know, much more prestigious chateaus,
yeah,
just because, you know, they've got a lot more marketing power.
Yeah, it's brand, isn't it? It's brand awareness, yeah.
It's brand awareness, yes.
And Isabel, do you find that people who come to your show actually find it a complete revelation in terms of taste? So somebody who's used to maybe spending £7 or £8 in a supermarket on a mass produced wine suddenly come, you know, to your raw wine event and actually really can tell the difference and come away with a very different way of thinking about wine.
For sure. I mean, look, it's exactly the same parallel as if you were thinking, I mean, obviously, you know, you're really strong in obviously in terms of food, you know, in terms of what you do, and if you think about raw wine, that's the equivalent to farmhouse unpasteurized cheese, you know, raw milk cheese versus something that you'll find on your supermarket shelf. You know, the taste intensity is greater. Their wines are really, you know, alive. They're full of personality. And to be honest, most people who I think sort of go and discover, you know, this side of in a way the wine industry, you know, it's very hard to go back. Once you've kind of, you know, tasted the wines and met the people,
you can't
it's
go
like,
back.
It's like going back to white sliced bread when you've kind of got addicted to sourdough bread.
Yeah, sure.
It's a bit like that.
So, Isabel, I know you've actually, if I can just talk about you for a minute, you've received a number of top awards, haven't you, in the wine world? And I think it's true to say that you're leading the way for women in wine, and you were the first ever French female master of wine, which actually is the highest accolade the wine world has to offer. How difficult was that? Because, I mean, British men are bad enough.
Careful.
How difficult was it to manage to achieve that?
This is a girl's talk. look, to be honest, I've lived in Britain for 20 years, so I've never really experienced a lot of the French wine industry. I think it's true that, you know, the wine industry by and large, you know, quite male dominated, but I think that's true of in a way a lot of industries.
Mm.
I've never experienced any issues or any blocks, or, you know, I've always been quite headstrong in terms of knowing what I wanted to do. I was always very committed to studying, to working, and I think, you know, I think the wine industry, and particularly, you know, the more artisanal side of the wine world is extremely welcoming of people who are very passionate and hardworking, regardless of gender. And I think that anybody out there, you know, thinking actually, you know, maybe I'd love to work in wine, and I think definitely go for it, and you can.
Well, that's really good to hear, and I know you've been named by the drinks business, one of the top 50 most powerful women in wine. I like the sound of that. So that's so well done to you.
Thank you.
We can just quickly go back to the.
I just like the sound of women in wine. It kind of ticks a lot
good,
of boxes for me.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So if we go back to the Raw Wine Fair, if anybody wants to hear about it, oh, look it up. It's rawwine.com, and it's taking place on the 12th and 13th of March at the Store venue on the Strand. And you'd welcome anybody, really, wouldn't you? People from the industry, anybody who's just passionate about wine, full stop.
Yes, passionate about wine, or just really curious about, you know, food, curious about meeting people who are real farmers, you know, with you know, fresh from the vineyard. You know, I know that coming to wine tasting can be a bit daunting because it's like you go into a room, there's over 150 growers, there's loads of people, you get a little booklet that gives you the name of all the wines. But I would say that you just need to go in. My top tip when you walk into the room is just look into people's eyes, see who's being really friendly and smiley, and go to them and just like be yourself and ask them the questions because they love what they do and you know they're coming to London to share all their stories with us.
That's a very
do you know
idea.
I really want to go.
Yeah, you
don't. Oh, there you go. Great.
No, well, it's pointless because I'm teetotal.
He doesn't drink
I don't
wine.
Drink wine.
Oh, well, there are spittoons everywhere, so you can spit.
I'm going to clear my diary and definitely come and visit. So
it sounds fun.
Brilliant.
Yeah, make sure you go to rawwine.com. And Isabel, thank you so much for joining us.
Been a pleasure.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show.
Cheers now. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We're going to go to Tony Kesterton in a minute at Blue and White Cafe. But first of all, Nikki Cartmell from the Hythe Brasserie. What's your policy on wine? Because it's a really tricky one, isn't it? About getting the best wine, but people don't want to pay too much. So how do you handle that?
It's very difficult. There is definitely a price sensitivity on it. And it depends on the night of the week. At the weekend, you're going to sell premium wines. Mm. And during the week, more often, you'll sell your house selection. Mm. Isabel, this sounds so interesting. I'm dying to get to the Raw Wine Fair. I really am. But it is quite a hard sell, I would imagine. I think certainly for my market, it is. But that's not to say carrying a little stock of something special like that doesn't appeal to your more discerning guests who like that kind of thing. Mm. And really, I think that market is growing.
Yes, I think sure. You're probably right. Mm. Well, we're going to talk loads more about what you do in a second. But first of all, we're going to turn to Tony Kesterton. Now, for anybody who doesn't live around where our radio studio is, the Blue and White Cafe is sort of like a famous landmark, I would say, because it's blue and white. Weird that, isn't it, Tony? when did it first open?
1933.
He
doesn't look old enough, does he?
It's incredible. No, Tony doesn't look old enough. No, I mean,
Thank you very much.
That's actually incredible, isn't it? So there has been a cafe on that site.
Yeah, in some form or another. Yeah. Mm.
And just for people who don't know the area, basically it's on a sort of main road and loads of lorries and cars go past and there's loads of parking. It's all on its own. It's not near anything else,
is it?
No,
not at all, no.
And it's just a bit of a local I don't know, what would you call it? A local attraction in a way.
It's sitting there on the A20, there a long time before the M20 was actually delivered, so that was the main route.
Funnily enough, the A20, before the M20 was built, had two or three cafes on it that were actually famous, like Johnson's Cafe out near Brown's Hatch was really well known. I'll show my age now because I used to go to it when I was a kid. So it's interesting that it's got that history, hasn't it?
Yeah, I would have thought back in the days it was really peaking, you know.
And it would have been the equivalent of a motorway service area then.
Definitely, yeah.
So it's been there for a very, very long time. You're famous for your breakfast. Mm-hmm. I've got a real thing about breakfast. I never used to have breakfast ever. And now, I don't know, I've got older and I also tend to go to the gym in the morning. I finish in the gym, I am starving. And I do want, fried eggs, I want bacon. Yeah. I feel I've earned it.
Yeah, definitely. And
is a cooked breakfast as popular as it ever was?
Yeah, despite definitely.
Despite all these scientific things we keep hearing?
Well, it's the mainstay in the cafe. It can be a healthy thing. It doesn't have to be unhealthy or greasy, depending on the quality of the ingredients you use. Mm. And at the Blue and White, we do try and use the best quality ingredients.
And
we
so who is coming in and eating cooked breakfast? Is it just like a whole range of people, or is it just truckers?
It's the full spectrum. It's you've got your builders in the week at the start, and then throughout the course of the day, you've got the police, you've got the ambulance, you've got the fire. Mm. Every walk of life comes in there.
So the police are in there having a bacon butty before they sort of nick somebody for speeding. is that how it works?
Yeah, they're there, yeah.
Do you serve the breakfast all day?
All day, the breakfast, yeah.
I'm liking this man more and more and more, you know.
Do people really have a cooked breakfast, you know, as in 3 o'clock in the afternoon?
Yeah, definitely.
Well, I suppose where you are, because of the Channel Tunnel, you might be getting lorry drivers actually who, for them, 3 o'clock in the morning is 3 o'clock in the afternoon is 6 o'clock in the morning, probably.
There's nothing wrong with having a fry-up at 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
No,
it's not. Trust me on this. There really isn't.
Well, bacon sandwich or sausage sandwich. Yeah, I'm not sure about.
I'm a breakfast man, as you can tell, looking at me. I like breakfast, but sometimes, I'll just for a change, I'll have porridge and toast or something for breakfast.
Yeah.
And then I think, do you know what? I really fancy some egg and bacon or whatever.
That's right.
So I'll have a late brunch or an afternoon breakfast.
Breakfast, yeah.
Any excuse is a good
excuse. Exactly, yeah.
So how are you managing to make a living when actually so many cafes are closing down? I mean, I've got a particular bugbear about, you know, some of the chains at Costa and Starbucks and Cafe Nero. Great though they are for very certain things, but they have absolutely decimated the old-fashioned cafe, haven't they?
They have, yeah. But maybe the old-school caf, you know, needed to come to the new age, effectively. Mm. They led the way, all this American imported cafes, and they had their quality that came with it. And all the British old-school cafs had to sort of step up to the mark if they wanted to compete. And it's those, unfortunately, that don't compete tend to go under. You've just got to raise your game and beat them at it.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I like is you can't get a proper breakfast in those places, not even a sausage sandwich. So they're all pre-packed in cellophane by some person who's made it probably at 4 o'clock in the morning somewhere, don't know where. And the sausage has already been cooked. It's already been buttered and it's stuck in this. And then they'll how do they heat it? In a microwave or something? God knows.
Yeah, they will do,
How can that be right for breakfast? It can't.
Well, it's not right, and it won't taste right either. What you need is your local cafe where things are cooked fresh and they've got quality ingredients. We use quality butchers for all our meats, and it is cooked fresh, and you can tell the difference that you've got a free-range sausage, local board sausage, homemade bubble, all fresh ingredients.
And how much would that cost?
You can start with a basic breakfast for $4.95.
See, I think some of those horrible plasticky ones aren't that far off.
No, they're not.
Are they? If you look at price comparison.
The thing that I like about what Tony's saying is, and it's absolutely right, in the evolution of cafes, for far too long, a lot of old-style cafes were cheap, horrible products, swimming in oil, not very well produced, not a very nice ambience in, I'm not talking restaurant ambience anyway, but, you know, there's a 4-mica table with some substitute ketchup on the table and stuff like that. You're not going to compete, are you? Well, the thing I like is talking quality food.
Yeah.
And when you talk about breakfast being healthy or unhealthy, it mostly comes down to the quality of the food and how it's cooked. Not what it is, but how it is, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
I know you've got a vast menu, though. It's not just about breakfast. So you really do sort of cook things that I think people think of English and they like, but you do them well.
Yeah.
So you've got chili, and burgers and, cottage pie and shepherd's pie and stuff like that.
Yep.
People still loving those things?
Definitely. We do a lot of homemade like you say, the cottage pie, the liver and bacons. But we're doing our homemade steak and ale pies, chicken and mushroom.
Liver and
even
bacon.
Making the pastry ourselves as well. Mm. And now we're doing steamed steak and kidney puddings. Mm. All homemade.
I'm getting all hungry all of a sudden.
Oh, my.
Steamed
what time do you shut?
Yeah. We're running from 7 till 3, 7 days a week.
Oh, we've missed it.
Steamed. I should have said I'd have brought
some steamed pudding. Now, I know on TripAdvisor that you're the top-rated cafe around here. Okay. And of the 129 ratings that we had a look at this morning, 125 of them are either very good or excellent.
Yep.
Now, that TripAdvisor and the way people now rate things is critical, isn't it? If you're in the sort of cafe restaurant sector,
you do get quite a few people coming in just based purely on those ratings, and you have to work at it. You have to try hard. You might only see that person for once, and you've got to impress them. Give them no reason not to come back. And the only way you're doing that, like you said, quality food, quality service, and hopefully that ticks all their boxes.
And I think that's the difference now, Paul. With those old cafes, people couldn't vent, their dissatisfaction.
Yeah, so you do.
They'd tell everybody they knew, but they wouldn't vent their dissatisfaction. Whereas now, you can't get away with producing bad because you literally will not exist, will you?
And I don't know what you think about this, but this is kind of my take on it as well. Back in the day, most roadside cafes were somewhere you passed and you went, oh, there's a cafe, I'll stop. You had a rubbish meal there, but you never went there again anyway, so who cares? You know, it's just on your drive. Nowadays, what we're looking at is an establishment that has been bypassed by the motorway, so the passing traffic isn't as great as it used to be. There is still passing traffic, obviously. So what Tony's getting is loads of repeat business. Yes. So people are coming back to his cafe where they didn't used to do that because of the quality and what it does. And that's, I think that's the big difference.
Yeah. I mean, we do get people coming in every day, seven days a week.
I can imagine.
Yeah. They're just working their way through the menu and they're loving it.
What's your top seller?
Yeah. Top seller would be a cottage pie, followed closely by the new steak and ale pie.
Right, okay.
Very nice.
Okay.
Vicky, can I ask you your opinion on that? At the higher end, you want to go. I can see you're licking your lips,
do.
Aren't you?
I love breakfast and I love traditional English food. I grew up with it and I adore it. And Tony's absolutely right. It's all about the quality ingredients and the way you produce it. Mm. I'll be there very soon.
I'd love to see you there, Nikki.
Yeah, definitely. We're gonna talk to Vicky in a minute about managing the kitchen and how that's important and especially when you've got people asking for things like gluten free, and that sort of stuff. How have you managed to sort your business out to make sure that it's really efficient and at the back end in the kitchen? Because all of a sudden you might get 15 people who turn up. It's not like, I presume with your restaurant, you can now say, I've got bookings at 8, I've got bookings at 8:15, I've got bookings at 8:30. But of course, Tony suddenly could get 15, 20 people turn up. How do you manage that in the kitchen?
15 gluten-free lorry drivers.
Yeah. Something like that.
It is challenging, but you have to be set up with, you can easily go onto a second griddle to cook extra. Everybody knows what they've got to do at the time it happens, and it's just being prepared. For any eventuality, we have had it where you have an order for 75 baguettes and things, but you may have had notice the night before because they must realise as well that you can't suddenly work miracles.
Yeah, can't suddenly come up with 75 baguettes.
But that's even hard, even with notice. With everything else that happens during the course of the day. But
Tony, what's your background? How did you get into this?
Well, I was actually living in London, had a normal job and
normal life.
He worked in Starbucks.
Warehouse manager for film and TV lighting, but all of a sudden the warehouse gets smaller as the years roll on and. I went to Devon, moved there and bought a cafe by the beach. Had no experience at all and, just learnt the hard way by mistakes and eventually moved over here, met up with Katie Camier, who owns the Blue and White, and we've gone on from strength to strength.
Is it something you enjoy? Do you think you've got to be passionate otherwise, because it's very hard work and it is long hours and it's antisocial.
You have to care to the point of the service that you provide. Mm. Otherwise, it's never going to work. Mm. And also, you have to be strong together to spend all that amount of time so close in a demanding role.
Mm.
So long as those key factors are there, then you can achieve anything, basically.
Well, coming over to Nikki, who I keep calling Vicky and Nikki intermittently. Sorry about that.
Everybody does.
Nikki, you work with your husband, Dara.
I do. Hartmill. Yes.
So you've got the same issue as Tony. How difficult is that? Or is it a good thing?
It has its moments.
Careful what you say, because he might be listening.
It has its moments. But generally, we've been doing it for a long time now, and we've kind of got a nice way of going on. We can work together pretty well. And our motto always is, what happens on the hot plate stays on the hot plate. It doesn't come home.
I see. I'm not going to ask any questions further on that.
I'm not getting involved in this conversation.
I'm not getting involved in that. Let's talk a little bit about yours now, Nikki. You've always sort of been involved in the food industry, really. I mean, you went to catering college.
I did.
And the interesting thing about you is that you studied marketing. So you got a master's in marketing.
Yeah, that's quite recent.
Was that really important to try and work out, this is really important to be good at catering, but this is a business?
Very much so. I mean, marketing is everywhere. It's all about the social media, among other things. And the course I did had a lot of concentration on that area. So really, it was about career development, perhaps a little bit later on, maybe some more consultancy, that kind of thing. But it is such a strong element of everybody's business now. And also, it was very interesting.
Yeah. Have you used, how have you been doing your marketing, Tony? Is it just on reputation for you? Or are you getting quite proactive?
No, it's more on reputation and TripAdvisor, to be honest.
Because I think with yours, it's about attracting people passing by and repeat business.
Yeah.
It's very, very different with your type of business, isn't it? I mean, what's the average spend in yours per head?
If evening time, you're talking an average spend of probably about £35 a head.
Yeah.
On a weekend. The weeknights are slightly different because we run a menu tailored, a set price menu that's tailored for evening business, which works really well. So again, that's part of your marketing. It's tailoring your menus to suit your different groups of people that are coming in. But it's
But you've got to attract four or five people in, four people in, say, or six people, two people. It's not just that almost impulse buy as you're driving past in a car.
No.
It's a different proposition, isn't it?
Very much so. I mean, it tends to be a planned event. It's a destination point. People have decided they're coming out either for a special occasion or just even if they're coming out for a bite to eat. They've still thought about it first, generally, especially if it's in the evening. Lunchtime, you might get passing trade, but in the evening, 9 times out of 10, it's pre-planned.
Yeah. And therefore, people's expectations must be very high. Because let's face it, if you've been working hard all week, you're saving your money and it's going to be, let's say, 150 quid for the four of you. You want it to be good, and it's got to be good every time, hasn't it?
It has. And also, it's quite often a special occasion. So there's a lot invested in that for people. If it's a special birthday, then that's got to go right for them.
Mm.
You know, and it's your job to get that right for them.
Mm.
But even if it's just a regular night out, as you say, £150 between four people is a lot of money. And in this day and age, that's a lot of money. You know, things are tight.
Probably not in London, but anyway, it's probably £150 a head in London.
We were a tad more provincial in Hythe, but you know what I mean. But definitely, you really do have to concentrate on getting it as special as possible for them and tailoring everything to individual needs. You know, different customers are different. They all have different requirements, different little quirks. And our job is to try and match our product and our service as best we can to each and every person that comes in the door.
Mm. It's notoriously difficult. I always read it's notoriously difficult to make money in the sort of high-end fine food, you know, restaurant sector. How do you... And so many places close. I mean, we've just heard recently, haven't we, that the Inn on the Green near you, that's actually he's got an amazing chef there.
Brilliant.
And he's closing down.
That's such a shame.
It's so sad.
But Jeff's a friend of ours, and it's gutting.
If he's got no business, he hasn't got any choice.
Exactly.
So how do you manage to stay there for so long?
I think we've developed a formula over the years. I'm always wary about saying that we're fine dining. We certainly produce a very quality product, and we use the very best of local ingredients, everything we can get, and really concentrate on developing our flavours. But what we would say is this kind of fine dining without frills. Our restaurant is quite basically set out. We don't use linen tablecloths. We don't use crystal glasses and things like that. So those costs all stay really low, because often you find those ancillary costs really can push things up.
Mm.
Also, because Dara and I run it almost alone, we only have four other staff, and three of those are part-time.
Mm.
That keeps the massive cost down. I don't have to pay him, and he doesn't have to pay me.
So
it works.
Based on results.
It's
got to be nice.
All based, absolutely result
based.
Yeah. We've got to be nice to each other. But that's really how we do it. We found a model that works. We keep it small, and we're hands on.
Mm.
And it's the hands on basis really that makes us able to do it as we do it.
Yeah.
And is utilization really key? So for you, you've probably worked out your business model, and you think we have to have this number, you know, of covers every month. You know, that's our baseline.
Yes, you do. I mean, there's sort of a minimum and a maximum, you know, and you try and usually hit somewhere in between, because if you're max all the time, that can just blow your chef out the water. He gets exhausted. And or she, in fact. And you don't want to be running at the minimum either. So you do have a certain balance that you want to reach. But you try and control that through your bookings. As you say, it's an advantage for us in our style to have pre-bookings and people having planned things, because we can make estimates and we can work. And also, Dara is an excellent kitchen manager. Our wastage is minimum. He really, really knows how to work his menus.
Well, that's another key, isn't it?
And also ordering locally.
Mm.
You can order daily and even half daily. Mm. We can often ring somebody just down the street and say, any chance we can get couple of cauliflowers or whatever it is, you know.
Yeah.
So that really, really helps our capacity there.
And you, Tony, is yours much more volume based? Is it about numbers for you?
It is,
Because the margins presumably are smaller, so you have to get just more numbers through.
You do, yeah. It is all about numbers. You have to, you know, you want them to enjoy the experience, but, you know, you want to get them in, then get the table back and hopefully get somebody else filling it again.
Have you finished that yet? Off you go.
Hurry up.
in a nice way.
In the nicest possible way.
Get some music that's really, really, you know, getting jolling them along.
Yeah.
Now, I know as well, Nikki, you've taken a business decision to really, really go for the gluten-free thing. Now, that is a really difficult undertaking in the kitchen. It is not as simple as having gluten-free bread over there and, you know, normal bread over there. Explain how you've set that up, because you really believe that that's a business decision that's paying off for you.
We do. We have many regular customers that return to us on the basis of the fact that our menu is almost completely adaptable for gluten-free. So most of the things we have on, most people can have. We cater for other dietary requirements as well, dairy and so on, but that's a little less of a concentration because of celiac disease. It's obviously a really important issue that we look after, the gluten thing. But on a practical level, it's all about your capability. You've got to know a little bit about your food science and make sure that you understand exactly what gluten-free means. And that means being very, very careful about cross-contamination. It means clean area. When you're producing a gluten-free product for somebody who has celiac disease, you really can cause a problem if you have any contamination for that person. So those kinds of things are where the practical difficulties come in. You've got to make sure that you are prepared physically within your workspace for it, and also that you, as a business owner and developer, make sure that you are capable, and also that your staff are sufficiently trained and that they understand what is required of them.
My daughter has celiac disease, and I thought, I know, because she's been to your restaurant, she loves it. I didn't believe in all that rubbish, like about 10 years ago, until she kept going to hospital and we couldn't work out what it was. It's very, very difficult because if say you're gluten-free and you're not, so there's a huge amount of trust if you've got celiac disease when you go to a restaurant. If it actually isn't gluten-free, we will be up to A&E that evening. You know, that's how catastrophic it is, and it's incredibly painful as well. So it is a very difficult thing to trust restaurants that they do that. And I know some of them don't really get it, and I do understand why they don't get it. But the reason why she likes coming to your place is because she knows she will be fine that night and the next morning, you know, whatever. And it's a great degree of trust, isn't it, in a restaurateur?
Trust is a massive issue. It really is. And I think customers generally have to feel they can trust you, whatever the issue is. They've got to trust that your local ingredients that you say are local are local, among other things. They've got to trust also something like this. They've got to completely trust in their safety with you. And I can see that that's really difficult for a lot of people. And you have to prove that to them. You know, you've got to really show that you can produce what they need.
One of the interesting, my dear old mum is gluten intolerant as well, and when I book a restaurant to take them out, and you ring and you go, look, my mum's gluten intolerant, and they go, yeah, no problem. You arrive at a restaurant and they give you a menu and you go, what's gluten free on here? And they go, oh no, the chef will make you something. And you think, you're not really very committed to this. Anything could happen here.
No, I think you're absolutely
you've absolutely separated your kitchen out, haven't you?
Have a small area that we work with. If we know we've got something, you know, that really has to be... And Dara will just clean down. He'll just completely clean down an area specifically for it because we've got a tiny kitchen. But it works very well. He works it on his own, so therefore, you know... But it is about commitment, Paul. You're 100% right. I mean, just because your customer has got celiac disease or some other dietary requirement, they are paying the same money as anybody else to come in your door and have an experience.
Exactly. Yeah.
Therefore, it is your duty, if you want that person as a customer, to give them the right experience to suit their needs.
And their family.
Because
they're going to book it.
Absolutely.
All of them are going to go if they know they can go.
That's the thing, it extrapolates out. You know, they bring other friends and they recommend their friends. We've had so much referral business.
Absolutely.
From the fact that we make this effort. And I think more and more restaurants are doing it.
Because you're saying is that it is a business decision and it's paying off.
It is paying off, absolutely. Mm. We believe that it is. Mm. Yeah, it's worth the effort.
Yeah.
As far as you're concerned, Tony, you obviously do vegetarian as well. And was that a real concerted decision? Is it something you kept getting asked for, or something that you feel that you should do?
It's just almost a standard thing these days to have a vegetarian option. We do have gluten-free options ourselves. Again, that is becoming more and more the requirement for an establishment to actually fulfil. So. You just have to go with market forces. If that's what they want, then that's what you give them.
I mean, I think if you look at the way sausages are made, actually not having bread and stuff like that is not so difficult in sausages and things like that, and obviously eggs, unless you're vegan, are fine. It's the bread thing that's difficult, isn't it? That's the one, that's the test for me. It's actually so difficult to get good gluten-free bread because gluten is an essential part of the texture of good bread.
Yeah, we certainly don't make our own gluten-free bread. We just go to the supermarkets, just buy it off the shelf there. And
there's some good stuff now, isn't there?
Yeah, you know, it's we don't get complaints on the gluten-free that we do. We can either do it as breakfasts or cakes. We can do those, or meals as well. So it's
cornbread.
And, Nikki, how have you managed the sort of bread side of it? Because you've been trying to make stuff, haven't you? And make pastry, but it's so difficult to get the texture right.
Very difficult to get the texture right. There's a lady actually who's now who lives in Hythe, funnily enough, and she came in to me a few weeks ago and we got talking, and she at one time did some consultancy and some work with Pizza Hut on gluten-free bread. She's got celiac disease. Brilliant lady called Jane Clark, and she now has started working with me a little bit on this, and she's been bringing me ambient bread mixes which I can mix and bake. Now she's done it's like a little chemistry set she brings in for me with all the bits in, and I can just make these up and bake them now, and there I can get a fairly good white bread loaf,
right,
which is very hard to get even off the shelf. You find the seedy ones are much better. But pastry one, more difficult.
Seedy ones are better because actually the seeds hold it together a little bit.
This is her, not to go into the science too much, but her thinking on it. And she pulls her bread mix together with dietary fibre. She uses psyllium husk, which really it's not quite the same as gluten, but it does have that binding sort of property. So we've been using those, and we've been sort of piloting those the last couple of weeks. It's been working really well. Mm. Yeah, people like it. And the fact that we say, oh, we make it here.
It makes a big difference.
Like, oh, do you? You know, and they'll eat it out to please me, I think, sometimes. You know? but it is really nice. Well, yeah. You know,
and Tony's,
to be able to
Tony's
offer
obviously put on these amazing steak and kidney puddings, and he's got these pies, which sound, I'm going to have to go and visit them, have some of those. Mm. What about pastry for you, gluten-free? Is that tough as well?
That is a really difficult one. Pastry is difficult. It's the holding and things like that. We are still
it goes really crumbly,
the,
doesn't it? You try and roll it out, and it all like completely
which can be a good thing. You know,
a
biscuity texture with some things is pretty good, but it really is about maintaining the standard and what people expect from you in a general way. So it's very hard to make it mainstream for every guest, but people who need gluten-free food, you know, it's hard for them, but there has to be a little bit of compromise, I think, for them in order with some things, which is very hard. And we will do our absolute best to get the best result we can for that product.
You can't work miracles, can you? You can only do what you can do.
No.
And as long as you do the best you can and you offer somebody something that is edible, fun to eat and pleasant.
That's right.
I was saying the amount of times you go into a restaurant and they'd serve a bread roll and I'd say, I'm sorry, my mum's doesn't have gluten, and they go, oh, that's all right, and they come back with a rice cake, and you think, oh, for goodness sake.
It's not making an effort, really.
It's not really the same thing. Yeah. No.
It's absolutely not the same thing. And just tell us a little bit about your menu. So I have been in a few times, I do like it there. You try not to offer too much because that makes it really efficient in terms of food waste. So what do you have, about 6-7 starters, 6-7 main courses, something like that?
Yeah.
Which for me is a sign of a good restaurant, because I know there's not loads of things getting whacked out of the freezer. What have you seen over time in terms of trends that people have sort of, you know, eating now as maybe as opposed to 5 or 10 years ago?
Oh, it changes all the time. It's really, really hard to keep a handle on it, you know. But you just watch the trends. I mean, 5 or 10 years ago, fusion was really big. But that's still in now. You're getting a lot of
fusion being
a blend of sort of
taking one
classical French cuisine, say, and influencing with a bit of Thai, for example.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
That's the kind of thing. But you're seeing a lot of Asian street food now. That's really becoming popular. That is a big trend. It's quite hard to work into our style, but you can pinch the odd flavour and the odd idea. Mm. So that, I think, is a very strong trend. Street food is a big
and the flavours to go with that.
You're really talking Far Eastern there. Yeah. You know, as far as Vietnamese, Thai, still, you know.
And how do you build that into what is traditionally a traditional sort of French brasserie that you've got there, the atmosphere that you have there?
You can really work with your traditional French methods, but then you're incorporating other flavours. And actually, it's amazing how different flavours will fuse together and work. Mm. But it's an experimental process. Dara's pretty good at it. He can almost put it together in his head and say that'll work or that won't. Then we'll test it, which is a really hard job to do all that tasting.
It's tough, isn't it? Do give me a ring if you ever need any help on that one.
But it's that's the kind of thing we do. And then we'll find, God, yeah, that really works. You get this real explosion where, you know, perhaps using one style on its own would have given you something good.
Mm. Yeah.
But it just put something on fire a wee bit, you know, when you add.
I mean, just looking on your website, for example, on your starters at the moment, you've got tempura monkfish with hot and sour dip. That's a real nod to those sorts of flavours, isn't it?
It is, yeah, very much so.
I bet that's really popular, isn't it?
Big seller, yeah.
Is it?
We've had it on in various restaurants of ours for years, that one. It kind of travels with us. It's one of those signature dishes that really flies.
You'd like that, wouldn't you?
I certainly would. Mm. I was just thinking, a couple of months back, we had a chap on the show here that is a futurologist about food.
Yeah, we were
talking about food trends, and he was predicting this street food and bowl food and things like that
as big
trends that are happening in 2017.
And how does Dara dream up things like sticky beef short ribs, which you're very famous for short ribs, aren't you, I think?
We are. Well, you pick it up as you go along a wee bit. But
he's got that with Cajun, you know, a Cajun puree. And again, that's those two things.
Well, the sweet and the sticky works with the Cajun spice. You know, each kicks the other off, you know. Mm. So that's, you know, you're borrowing cuisines again.
But that's part of the fun, isn't it? Isn't that part of the fun of doing food now that we I'm dribbling.
But it's not finite. I mean, food is infinite. And cooking is infinite. Mm. You can really go anywhere you want to with it.
It's another one, because I went there the other week and I don't think I had this in the end, but seared pork fillet with Jack Daniel's and blue cheese sauce. What do you think about that, Tony?
It sounds absolutely wonderful. I can't wait to actually get down to the
anytime
the brasserie and try some of these for myself.
But sauces actually are a bit easier in terms of gluten-free, aren't they? Because you don't need flour to make a sauce, let's face it,
properly. No, you certainly don't. I mean, Dara works everything from fresh. He makes stock from bones. Mm. So we're building everything up in flavour layers as you're going along. So really, all you've got to do is keep unthickened stocks, and then you can either reduce with cream or whatever it is, or you can thicken with other things than glutinous flours. There are so many
ways
of doing it. Potatoes are good for soups. Yeah. But you know, you're doing tomato-based sauces and also vegetable purees for sauces. Mm. Those are brilliant. And if you're health conscious, those work really well. I mean, we use a fair few rich sauces with the French style, so that there's quite an emphasis on sauce with us. Mm. But you know, now again, with trends, you are leaning towards these more vegetable-based things that offer a lighter solution, you know,
which I think people want something not as stodgy as they used to.
They certainly do, and you know,
well, we asked Tony about his background. He's obviously, you know, working in warehouses. Then he trots down to Devon, and then he's opened up here. Your background, is it Northern Ireland? I got that right.
Yeah, that's where my husband's from. My husband is a Tyrone man, and we met there and had restaurants there for a good few years. We worked in the hotel sector there, and then we went into out on our own.
So you had an oysters restaurant. What did you serve there? That was in Strabane, was it?
That was in Strabane, and that was actually it was called Oysters, which is very odd. But there's a long story behind that name, but it's too complicated. But actually, our big sale—it was a border town. Our big sale was beef. Irish beef is great, and we really sold steak.
You like
it
that?
It was
don't
a
you, Paul?
Big steaky menu.
Cooking on gas for me now.
Absolutely, but then we were already mixing flavours at that stage as well. So you were doing other things. You might have been serving steak with chili and garlic prawns, you know, tiger prawns or something like that. So you were we were introducing these interesting other flavours, you know, at that stage even then.
And then I believe you owned a spice restaurant in Derry.
That was
really going into your spices.
That was in the fusion days then. That was when that trend was really prevalent. So that's where we went with that one. We went to fusion with that and that did a roaring trade.
Why opening in Derry? I mean, some people worry about being in Derry full stop.
We lived there. We lived there and we met in a restaurant in Derry some years before when we were working there.
It's all romantic, this, isn't it?
Isn't it lovely?
Yeah. It sounds it, I know. But we liked it. We were very lucky. We had our businesses after the Northern Ireland ceasefire in 1994. We had our first restaurant in 1999. Mm. So we really had the best of times when there were a lot of investment in the country after everything settled down. Mm. And we really had a great time and we left just after recession hit, so really we had the best years. And it was great.
And were you serving wine there? Because obviously they're great beers, both in Northern Ireland the mainland Ireland. But were people into wine there?
They were, very much so. Among other things, we find here it's very much a wine-based market within the restaurant. Other things do sell, but it might be one gin and tonic, where it might have been three before dinner over there, you know. So,
I love the Irish.
The Irish love to drink.
I love the Irish.
It's great. but very mixed, but certainly, and very discerning. The Irish market we found in Northern Ireland anyway, where we were, very discerning. They know their food and they know their wines and they have access to brilliant produce. Mm. You know, especially some of the meat and fish. You know, there really is a lot of excellent produce.
Just while we could talk for ages, but we're just coming to the end of the programme. Just from both of you, really, a lot of people believe that running a restaurant and owning a restaurant is one of their, you know, their dreams. You know, I'm just saying that.
Dreaming about stopping.
Yeah. Nikki's just laughing her head off there, off the microphone. But a lot of people do. It's something that they would really like to do. First of all, Tony, what words of advice would you give? If somebody wanted to set up a cafe, you know, the 7 till 3, that's perfect for me. I want to serve people. A lot of people who get restaurants want to please people, don't they? They want to cook for them. What's the single piece of advice you would give?
Be prepared for a lot of hard work, long hours, and you will work like you've never worked before, and you've got to stay at it, be dedicated, but try and enjoy it. That gets you through the day and keep smiling.
Can I just ask a quick question? You had a cafe in Devon, beach cafe. What have you seen? One of my favourite cafes is the Galleon Cafe on Polzeath Beach, which is opposite Padstow in Cornwall. I used to have a home down there. What's the biggest difference between running a beach cafe and a roadside cafe?
You get 6 months off a year running a beach cafe.
Okay, smart move.
Good thinking.
Smart move. And Nikki, if anybody really fancies being a restaurateur, what advice would you give them?
Don't do it.
No. Don't.
we know it's hard work, but you've got to run it as a business.
That is absolutely the crux of the issue. Remember, it is a business. It's not your dining room. You are running a business. And again, do keep smiling. It absolutely saves your life if you smile and have a sense of humour. But it is a business. It's also incredibly important to know your market, what the people around you and the people you want to attract, what is it they want, and give it to them.
And making sure you do, and at the right price point.
That's very much so.
All that sort of stuff.
All your marketing principles.
Yeah. Mm. Okay, well, personally, I'd never be a restaurateur because it is extremely hard
work.
It's
very hard
work. Very, very difficult. And margins are tough. Mm-hmm. And suppliers are everything as well. Quality, isn't it? You've got to search for those. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for joining us. Mm-hmm. It was really good to hear about, from Isabel about the Raw Wine.
Raw Wine, and that sounds like a great event. When's that happening again?
It's on March the 12th and 13th.
In the Strand.
Mm. And actually, I think definitely Nikki and I fancy going down there. Mm. It's something called the Store Venue. And I really like the fact that she has got this very, very strict criteria for entrance. You know, in terms of you're not allowed to be there as a wine producer unless you've ticked all these.
I'm trying to think where it is. I think that's next to the Coal Hog, isn't it?
I don't know.
On that side of the Strand.
I don't know. I don't know if I know where it is, but the Strand's not very big, so that's fine. Yeah. And artisan wine movement in the UK. I think that's interesting. And again, I'm sure. Do you serve wine in the cafe?
No, it's not licensed at all.
I was going to say, you don't have people rocking up and saying, can I have, you know, at 6 o'clock in the morning, can I have a fried slice? And have you got a nice Chablis?
Have you got a pretentious Prosecco to go with a Gutbuster
nice,
special?
Have you got a nice Chablis to go? People don't ask that, do they?
Do they
ask for beer?
No, they just know.
No.
Fizzy drinks, cappuccinos, lattes, that's about it. Yeah.
Tea, builder's tea.
So you don't have to worry about that?
No, not at all.
Okay, that's good. I think fizzy is the only thing that you would have for breakfast, isn't it? You wouldn't have anything else, I don't think.
So what, in terms of wine?
Yeah, you'd only have like Prosecco or champagne, wouldn't you? You don't know.
Champagne breakfast.
Yeah, champagne breakfast.
Yeah.
You don't do breakfast, do you?
No, we don't.
No, don't blame me. You've got
enough's
to have a lie
enough.
In.
Yeah.
What's that stuff where they put orange juice in it?
That's champagne. Yeah.
Bucks Fizz, isn't it?
Bucks Fizz.
Yeah, that's not a good idea in my personal opinion. So, 12th and 13th of March, go on to the website rawwine.com. I'd like to say thank you very, very, very much to Nikki Cartmill and obviously her husband, Dara, isn't here because presumably he's working hard.
He's working.
Back at the
lodge. Yeah.
And if anybody's around the Kent area, anywhere near the Channel Tunnel, if you're going on holiday, hythebrasserie.com. I'd recommend it because it's one of my favourite local restaurants. And I need to go back because I haven't been for a little while, Tony. And I know you're going to go, aren't you? You're going to try it for the Blue and White Cafe.
Do you open Saturdays?
7 days a week.
I'm coming Saturday.
Yep.
I'm coming for breakfast on Saturday.
Tony,
gird your loins. Yeah. I'm going to eat my way through your menu.
Tony Kesterton from the Blue and White Cafe. Thank you for joining us. And if you want to find out about Blue and White Cafe, TripAdvisor, I think, just plug that in TripAdvisor and I can guarantee you, you'll get great reviews and you can see what people are saying about it.
Yep.
That's it, more or less, Paul.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us. A great lineup of guests, some fantastic insights into running different types of food businesses and wine. But that's it for another week. Thank you for joining us on the Food Talk Show. Don't forget, you can find loads of recipes, podcasts, and all kinds of information on our website.
foodtalk.co.uk.
It's the foodtalk.co.uk.
Brilliant.
Check it out. We'll be back with you soon. Take care. Have a fabulous week, and we'll see you all soon. Bye for now.
Bye.